The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events, and I'm very pleased to welcome our guests this evening. The Nobel Prize-winning playwright, novelist, and founder of the London School of Economics, George Bernard Shaw, famously said, "If all the economists were laid end to end, they'd never reach a conclusion." Tonight, I'd like to forecast that our speakers will put paid to that sharp remark, but don't quote me on it. Alan Greenspan began his storied career as a working and professional musician after studying the clarinet at Juilliard, which explains the Benny Goodman soundtrack that you heard as you entered the hall this evening. Turning from the mathematical structures that compose music to economic models, he went on to earn his BA, MA, and PhD in economics from New York University. In 1954, he co-founded the economic consulting firm Townsend Greenspan and Company, and from 74 to 77, he served as chair of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Gerald Ford. In 1987, President Ronald Reagan appointed Greenspan chair of the Federal Reserve Board, a position he continued to hold for five terms through both Republican and Democrat administrations until his retirement in 2006. Mr. Greenspan detailed his experiences at the Fed in his number one bestseller, The Age of Turbulence. 6 years on, we convene this evening to discuss his latest work, The Map and the Territory: Risk, Human Nature, and the Future of Forecasting. A recent review in the Wall Street Journal called the book a model of expositional clarity, with complex and recondite matters made accessible to the lay reader. The book should be must reading for anyone interested in the way our financial markets work and sometimes fail to do so. Tonight, Mr. Greenspan will be interviewed by Mark Zandi, chief economist of Moody's Analytics, a frequent guest on NPR, Meet the Press, CNN, and most recently the author of Paying the Price, Ending the Great Recession, and Beginning a New American Century. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Alan Greenspan and Mark Zandi to the Free Library.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks, Andy, for the introduction, and thank you, Free Library of Philadelphia, for the opportunity to be here. It is certainly an honor to be able to chat with Dr. Greenspan. I'll have to say I am a little freaked out because Dr. Greenspan's wife, Andrea Mitchell, is in the front row. And, I am an economist, really, not... I don't do this for my day job. Let's put it that way. So please forgive me. Yeah. Oh, you don't do what I do. Okay. All right. Fair enough. But it is certainly an honor to be here with you, sir. You are an icon and certainly a very important part of my formative years as an economist was reading the speeches and listening to your testimony, and it was very important for me as an economist, and I want to thank you for that. Your contribution was really quite important, I think, and still is to the economics community. I read your book. I liked it a lot. Maybe we can begin with a softball question. I think it's a softball question. Map and the territory. What does that mean?
This book is essentially a detective story. It's a story of how was it possible all of the major forecasters of note missed the day when the most important crisis in our lifetimes occurred. And I said to myself, how is that possible? What is wrong with our profession if we can't at least sense the very big deals? And so what the book set out to do is to go strip down all of our assumptions and start from scratch and say, what do we do? How do we build up ideas? And that is basically the issue of when, for example, in the 15th century, we'd have maps of North America. They didn't look exactly like North America must have been at that time. And I essentially feel as though what I'm trying to do here is to get a map, which is the conceptual framework which explains the territory. The territory is the real world, what goes on, and why it goes on. If I succeed in this book, it will be, it's good geography.
Right, right. Well, I'm glad you got that answer correct. That was very impressive. So, in trying to explain why forecasters got it wrong, and unfortunately, I have to include myself in that group. I didn't quite get it right. You focus on behavioral economics. The idea being that most of the models, the economic models we use, are based on the idea that that we're rational behavior. We perform rationally as consumers, as business people, as investors. But in fact, there's a great deal of irrationality in our behavior, and to a significant degree, that helps to explain that irrationality, that helps to explain why the forecasters got it wrong, that in our models, we don't account for that behavior adequately.
Don't account for it properly.
Yeah.
It's not that the model builders are saying that people are rational all the time. The issue is something somewhat technical. They're saying, essentially, yes, people behave stupidly, intuitively, emotionally, considerable amount of the time, but it is random. It has no systematic component in it. And the only way to produce goods and services is through syllogistic, rational thought. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence of that, they believed that you could build our mathematical models on that presumption, knowing full well that people do not behave exactly as you're expecting, but it doesn't matter. The truth of the matter is, it matters a great deal. Mm-hmm. And as I went through my sort of detective and analysis of why was I wrong type of thing, I began to realize that I was assuming things which are not true. I mean, for example, what the data show when you really look at them is that fear is a far more potent force for economic behavior than is euphoria or greed. Mm-hmm. And that fundamentally describes a goodly part of what goes on in the economy, coupled with herding instinct. People tend to herd. And I was just over at the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia this afternoon, and I discussed bubbles. Mm-hmm. Bubbles are basically a non-rational type of economic behavior, and I indicated that's what we deal with. And unless and until we can deal with those properly and know what to do with them, we're going to miss the boat.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I want to come back to bubbles in a few minutes, because I'd like to know where the next bubble is going to be. That would be quite helpful if you could.
I thought you were going to
help us with that. Okay. of all of the sort of emotions that enter into the calculation, is it fear that is the most potent?
Yeah, fear is by far the most potent. And I list in chapter one of the book, maybe 15, 20, various different propensities. I call them propensities because some are inbred and they will never change. Others are learned and very difficult to root out. They're deep cultural issues. And but you line them all up and fear is so dominant the way people respond. And the way you can tell, for example, is when markets go down, they go down far faster than when they go up. Mm-hmm. And as you know, the unemployment rate rises much more rapidly than it declines. And that statistical analysis type of available, that shows up in every commodity, in every market. And one of the things I was doing with this book is trying to see whether or not we have enough information of that asymmetry between fear and euphoria to model it in a manner which will give us successful forecasts, certainly far better than we've made.
I have a theory. I'd like to try it out on you if I could. My sense is that the financial crisis was the combination of a more garden variety typical financial event created by, you know, excesses in primarily the mortgage market but in other parts of the credit market, that we would have had a financial event almost regardless of what policymakers did. But the reason why the financial why it turned into a financial crisis, why it devolved from a financial event into something that was catastrophic, the Great Recession, was botched policy. I'm not speaking monetary policy or fiscal policy, but resolution of failing institutions. So Bear Stearns was the first institution that went down. Then we went on to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and then a week later, Lehman Brothers. In each of those cases, the creditors in those institutions, so the stockholders and the bondholders, were treated differently. So that by the time we got to Lehman, the creditors in the financial system didn't know where they stood, and they bailed. And they said, I'm out of here, and the system collapsed. And, of course, Dodd-Frank, the regulatory reform, took a crack at trying to address this resolution authority issue. Do you think that's a big part of it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you can literally see what was happening. I, for example, think at the time and in retrospect that it was a mistake to bail out Bear Stearns, because by doing so, you essentially said that any financial institution which is larger than Bear Stearns, remember, Bear Stearns is a relatively small investment house, assumed that they will ultimately get bailed out. And it took a long time between, for example, the Bear Stearns crisis and Lehman, which was the fundamental break in the system. And had Lehman, for example, fully believed that unless they got their house in order, they would be bankrupt and out of business, they had enough time between Lehman and when the crisis occurred there to have significantly altered their balance sheet in a manner which could very well have prevented them from being in trouble. Remember, that firm goes back into the 19th century. And one issue which I do raise parenthetically in the book, which is relative to this, is that I think one of the major policy mistakes is 1970, where the New York Stock Exchange allowed broker-dealers who were then previously always partnerships to incorporate. Now, there's a very big difference between those two. I remember when they had partnerships, they wouldn't lend you a nickel overnight. I mean, and the reason is each and every partner is severally and individually legally responsible for what the other partners do. And they wouldn't let anybody do anything. When you go into a corporation, that barrier is changed. And I think had we still stayed with that structure of institutions, this type of crisis would have still occurred. We would still have had a bubble. But this was a very different one. And it would not have had the nature and the consequences that it did had we been back in the old organizational type of regime. People will argue, well, you couldn't raise capital adequately without incorporating. And I say that's precisely the point. because their ability to do all of that was one of the reasons why the distortions occurred, mm-hmm. and why this was not the largest economic catastrophe in the United States. It was surely the most devastating global financial crisis, mm-hmm. because this was the first time in a very long period of time that not only did markets crash, but they ceased to function. That had never happened during the 1930s. Mm-hmm. The last time a market actually shut down in the United States was 1907 for one day. Mm. This, including the breakdown in trade credit markets, was the first time when we actually had a global inability of the system to work, and it has taken us a very long time to come back out of that mess.
Mm. That's an interesting point. I hadn't put it in that kind of historical context. Just one more question on this issue, and then we're going to move on. So if you buy into the idea that one of the key reasons this was a cataclysmic financial crisis was the resolution process, the way we address these failing institutions, isn't that inherently unpredictable? I mean, there's no way that any model will ever pick that up, right? You would not be able to predict September 2008 under any condition.
There's a very, very good reason why, and we may get into that later, but I agree with that, you can't. And so this then raises the question, well, if you cannot stop a bubble, and you can't because it's human nature evolving, and there's a lot of people think, well, you can diffuse bubbles. Good luck. It doesn't work. I tried. So the issue is, what do you do? Well, you try to make certain that the consequences of the bubble are not devastating. The vast proportion of bubbles actually deflate. They cause horrendous pain to the people who own the toxic assets, but they have very little impact on the economy as a whole. The dot-com boom, for example, was a huge collapse in stock prices. You can't barely see it in the GDP. Mm-hmm. 1987, we had the largest mm-hmm. decline in one day on record. It was devastating. Mm-hmm. I can remember the second day we were worried about the whole thing falling apart.
I was still in graduate school, so I didn't quite get my mind around how bad it was.
Let me tell you this. It was very, very scary.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the result of that is... surprisingly, the end result was surprisingly benign. It had no lasting effect on economic activity.
And some would say because of your good stewardship at the Federal Reserve.
I don't accept that. It's nice to hear, but having been there, answer is no way. The whole point here is that if you can make them all benign, mm-hmm. you can... essentially make, if people want to go speculate in certain stocks or certain other things, they make a lot of money. When the markets go down, they lose a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But they don't have any effect on anybody else. Mm-hmm. One, basically because they are not leveraged. What distinguishes, for example, the crisis of 2008 and the dot-com boom is that the dot-com boom, some of the crazy stocks that were held there, were held by 401ks, pension funds, insurance companies, and households, which have very little debt. And the way you get a 2008 crisis is of necessity to have default on debt and contagion. Mm-hmm. If those two characteristics are not there, you will not have what happened. And the only way you can prevent that from happening is make certain that the financial institutions have enough capital. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a big dispute going on now, as you well know, mm-hmm. about what's the appropriate capital requirements for banks. I think the discussions are around numbers which are far too low.
Because,
I don't think that it's that difficult to do. And in fact, you know, right now, the commercial banking system's got 11% equity. In the early part of the 20th century, 1903 and 4 and 5, it had 20%. And it's hard to believe this, but back before the Civil War, it was 50%.
Is that right?
So there's nothing sacrosanct about mm-hmm. any of these numbers, but what is the case is that if you do not have enough capital, you can create you, but by definition, you have debt, and if you default on your debt, that's where the problem is. Mm-hmm. And as far as I can see, the issue is very readily resolved by having banks have enough capital so that when a crisis occurs, it's their shareholders that take the full brunt.
Do you have a number in mind? Like the Vitter Brown is 15%.
I would say more than 15, 20%.
Oh, you would?
Yeah, and the reason I would say that is what the data do show uh-huh. is that, what the argument will be from the banks is that their rate of return will go down dramatically.
Right.
But we have very interesting history. We had in the United States a very significant decline in capital to asset ratios all through the 19th century. Yet the rate of return on equity was stable. Mm-hmm. And the way that happened is that this is a lot of technical issues, but it's really mm-hmm. important that the net income per assets mm-hmm. Were falling at the same time. And I think that the reverse of that process is perfectly credible, that the markets will readjust in such a manner is that the loss, because you have to pay more, you have a much higher amount of capital, will be offset by increasing the spread mm-hmm. of profitability mm-hmm. on the aggregate asset structure by the way that interest rates and asset prices are priced. Mm-hmm. It's the reverse of what happened in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. That's the only way I can see out of this, because there is no way to prevent bubbles. Mm. There is no way to prevent them from collapsing. Mm-hmm. And what we have to do is to make sure that it is only the shareholders of those types of institutions who suffer, not the taxpayer, not the public in general. And that's what happened, for example. As I said, the dot-com boom, 1987, you can't see any real significant changes mm-hmm. in the GDP mm-hmm. despite collapses in stock prices.
I want to ask one more question about the book, and then I want to ask you a question or two about what's going on right now. But one more question about the book. When I was reading it, the one thing that I found, controversial from my perspective, was on around page 208 when you started talking about entitlements. And you talk, the sentence is basically, since Medicare in 1965 and the growth in entitlement programs over that period, that has reduced growth in the U.S. by about 0.2% per annum. Just to put that in context, over a 50-year period, that's about 10%.
It's a big number.
It's a big number. And just for folks in the audience, I did economists would call it back of the envelope. It's about $5,500 per person in America. So my read of what you were saying there is that the entitlement programs have had a significant, meaningful impact on our standard of living. Is that a fair characterization?
I have to expand on it because what has happened is it's a combination of the entitlement programs coupled with the increasing inequality of income. What the entitlements do, take for example, just Social Security, for example.
Yeah.
The real problem in Social Security is that we're not funding them correctly. The actuaries of the Social Security Administration, in the report that they issue every year, say that these programs are not properly funded. The way Roosevelt set them up in 1935 to replicate private pension funds. Everyone who receives Social Security believes it's their money, they've earned it with interest, and they get it back. The actuaries are saying no. Mm-hmm. There's a very large amount of subsidization in here which is creating all sorts of distortions. Had we had much higher contributions for social insurance and had them viable, then the issue of this 0.2% wouldn't be happening, because with the inequality of income, we're getting an increasing amount of income in the upper income quintile. Mm-hmm. And that is where those are the people who actually do the savings in the society. So that if you tax those people at just normal rates and take the cash and pay benefits, you have essentially converted savings into consumption. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that the data clearly indicate is a sad and very ironic issue here, that the endeavor to do good is creating the low level of income. In other words, mm-hmm. we have a social security system, which everything when things is work, and yet we have Kmart people holding up signs that their income is too low. Well, yes, it's because the productivity levels are not growing, that the issue of the savings going down means that capital investment is going down as it is. And as you well know, the only way you get productivity growth is to build up the capital stock by investment. So the great irony of this thing is
that
people what you're fundamentally doing is hurting some people at the expense of others.
So does that mean if you were king for the day, or you a week, you got a week,
I'll take 10 seconds and that's it.
Really?
That's all I want.
I'd like you to take a week, please. We need some real help, as you know. Would you fundamentally change Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid?
No, I would just increase the taxes.
You would?
Yeah, in other words, fund it correctly.
Yeah.
Listen to the actuaries who know what they're
just
talking about.
Just fund them.
Yeah, the problem basically is that, for example, during the 2012 campaign, for example, you had AARP actually saying in an ad that had a couple of people who were obviously actors, you know, we've earned it. It is our money.
Yeah.
President Obama said very much the same thing. Now, the problem here is that statement, which they believe, I mean, it's not as though they seriously and correctly believe, because they're being told it's their money. What the actuaries, the mathematicians who are looking at these programs, are basically saying year after year is that statement is not true.
Mm-hmm.
That we started off in 1935 replicating defined benefit programs which the private sector had and still do, but we drifted away from that. And the reason that I'm going all the way back, the key to Medicare is it's not so much Medicare, mm-hmm. it's 1965 where the data begin to show very clear evidences of that. And I think it's sad, and it's easily resolved. And I'm reasonably certain that if the individuals receiving Social Security believed it was charity, they wouldn't take it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very, very interesting quote in the book, mm-hmm. which I think is really fascinating. I was involved with the Social Security Commission in 1983. Mm-hmm. Back in the last century.
You saved it the first time.
Yeah. And it looked as though, you know, we had a problem then where the trust funds were running out of money. And there is a technical issue where all that you would have to do is to transfer some general revenues into the trust fund just by essentially just making an entry. Yeah. It has no real economic significance, but it solved the problem. And I said, that's the politically easiest way to get out of this thing. And so I said in the first very, I was in the chair, and I said in the very first meeting, if we're going to do that, let's do it now and get it over with. Claude Pepper, who was then in his 80s and but had been a very important component in Roosevelt's development of the Social Security system, said inimitably, he said, I won't get his voice quite right, but he said, Mr. Chairman, that is an outrageous recommendation. If we were to do what you're suggesting, that would make welfare, that would make Social Security welfare, and I will not support it. That was the general view of everybody at the time, and correctly. And I don't think that you would find the support for Social Security, as broad as it is, if people believe they were not getting what it was earned themselves.
I'm going to ask you to put your forecaster hat on. I know you kind of said I can't forecast, but I'm going to make you because I think you are a good forecaster. Here we are today, 4.5 years into an economic recovery, as defined by the National Bureau of Economic Research. It's been a tough, was clearly a bad, very bad recession, very tough economic recovery. We got some good economic news today. Feels like we're starting to create more jobs and unemployment starting to come in. What do you think? Are we going to kick into a higher gear here or not in 2014 and 15?
Well, I know everyone thought those data were very good this morning. I was disturbed by them. Let me tell you why.
Bummer. That's all I have to say. by the way, that sentiment I just expressed, everyone in the room just was thinking.
We were just talking about the fact that the wage rates in the middle to lower income groups are not rising and that people are having are really suffering and they're going out in the streets trying to get their wages increased when the poor store owners can't afford it because they don't have the profits. And so that they're trying to do that, and they can't because productivity of the economy is not going well. And so that the problem here is that if you see a very big increase in hours worked, which is what happened in the report this morning, but no corresponding increase in output, that is basically saying that's well and good, but if it is not, doesn't correspond to an increase in output, it's actually negative, not positive. And I worry about that, and I think that we may very well get a lot of employment, but I will tell you, they cannot be in real wages cannot go up faster than the productivity growth. And this says that productivity growth is slowing down even more than before, and it's going to mean there will be more people who are working, but you'll see it in their paychecks, which are not going to be moving at all.
So you're saying we could, in fact, see more jobs next year?
I think we will.
Yeah, but it won't translate into wages, at least not to the degree that we would hope, because of the lack of productivity growth.
Yeah, no, you cannot have increased wages over the long run without corresponding almost dollar-for-dollar productivity increase. Right. That's where wage increases and rising standards of living come from.
Yeah. Well, I was hoping that the response to that question would lift us higher, because the next question is going to take us lower. So, I think. I would very much appreciate if you could help us kind of scour the planet and tell us, where do you think the next, if not bubble, the next kind of vulnerability is, or where we should be looking, or how we should be looking at it. Just some context around that. You know, obviously that's a concern given we've been through several rounds of bubbles that are quite debilitating when they pop. So we'd like to...
Yeah, let me turn the question around. Yeah. Where do you think... You're in this business and you're looking as much as I do. Where do you think it's coming from?
Well, I'm actually optimistic. I think that our prospects are quite good. I think American companies are in tip-top financial shape. Their balance sheets
they are. There's no question about
that. And that the only thing that's missing is confidence. And the only reason why we haven't seen that spark is because of Washington. And I think the budget battle, we have one more round of budget battles to come. I think they're going to be resolved reasonably, if you can use the word gracefully, let's use it. And then we get into next year and we're going to see businesses step up and start to expand, invest, and hire more. So I'm optimistic. And I,
It's not the issue of hiring, it's investing that's
critical. Investing. I think they'll invest as well. I think they've been, and you've said this many times, you've been saying this for the last couple, 3 years, that the uncertainty has been a significant weight on investment, particularly long-lived investment, where the uncertainty would have its biggest impact. And I believe that. I think that's exactly right. But I'm optimistic that the uncertainty is going to fade and to a sufficient enough degree that we're going to get to a Field of Dreams moment where we're going to get that investment. And I feel that American companies in particular are very competitive globally and will invest aggressively. And so I'm more optimistic. And I don't think we have the vulnerabilities. We will have them because, as you rightly point out, irrationality will take hold at some point and we'll make mistakes. But I think we're a long way from that day. So I feel optimistic about things.
Yeah, I'm less so. And the, and the reason is that...
We knew that.
Before I showed up in government for 20 years, I had a very extensive experience as a private consultant in business. In fact, my first client was at 16th and Locust, right over here.
Is that right?
The Wellington Fund.
I'm trying to think, 16th and Locust.
Yeah. I guess it's still there.
Yeah.
But the point here is that when you... I've sat in on, I cannot tell you how many corporate management meetings determining this. And what happens is that in order to make an investment, they start off by asking product managers to devise where they think the future product development will be and what type of facility do we need to do that. And then all the accountants get involved and everything, and they come up with a rate of return, say, of 20% a year, which is a big number. Mm-hmm. And then the next question is, what is the spread, the variance? You know, I mean, it may well be true that 20% is the most reasonably expected forecast, but it ranges between, say, minus 10 and plus 40. That minus 10 really matters. Mm-hmm. And we are in that sort of environment today where the nature of the uncertainty is more in what I would call the variance of forecast. It's not the technical capabilities of making a lot of money. You can, but it's far more risky. And one of the reasons why the long-lived assets, why we have significant suppression, not in software or in computers, and you know, of life expectancy of 3 to 5, 7, 8 years, they're doing reasonably well.
Mm-hmm.
But buildings, mm-hmm. Long structures, infrastructure of various types are not, in large part because what the data show is that the rates of return on very long-lived assets are being heavily discounted.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons, essentially, is that most corporations right at this moment could not tell you within a reasonable range what the tax rate on that facility is going to be.
Good point.
for income derived, for example, over the very long run. And that means it falls into that sort of loss category. And I think the balance sheets of American business are terrific. They have a huge amount of liquid assets, and the reason is they've got a good cash flow, partly because earnings of workers are lower, which is another story, and one of the it's got to do with unions and their actually the proportion of unions in American industry, as you know, is going down very dramatically. That's had a very interesting effect on earnings and on profits, and so that the data of cash flow are very high, but they don't know what to invest in. So they're building up this big block of liquid assets, which President Obama said, well, you ought to go invest those. And they're basically saying, in what?
Well, we're going to open it up to the audience. I do want to point out one thing, though. I asked Dr. Greenspan where the bubbles were, and they must teach this at Central Bank University or something. He didn't actually tell us. Did you notice that? He asked me the question. I thought, very, very good. Excellent. Great job. But maybe you'd like to ask him the same question again. So what do you think?
I'll deflect it to you.
I see the woman in the middle over on the right. Can you please stand up and identify yourself and ask your question?
I'm Linda. I wanted to know to what extent, if any, the loss of manufacturing in this country has hurt the economy, and whether or not you see a tendency of manufacturing coming back, and if so, how long would that be, and would it, in fact, affect the long term?
It's a very interesting question, because everyone is aware of the fact that the decline in productivity that we're talking about seems to square with the declining share of manufacturing and factory jobs in the United States. And there's no doubt that when we came out of World War II, the technical skills of the workforce, very high proportion having high school diplomas, which was a big deal back then, they moved into they moved into the factory structure of the United States, which is very big at that time, and they did the types of semi-skilled and skilled jobs at auto assembly plants or steel mills and the like, and they worked their whole lives in individual plants, and that was the hardcore of American prosperity through the 50s and the 60s and into the 70s. I would say, put it this way, the technology of the economy and ideas changed, what you got was a very large downsizing of the weight of the GDP. And this is, I think, I don't know this for sure, but I raised this issue in the book, that I think it's caused by the fact that as we got more and more manufacturing, we got more and more pollution and more devastation of resources, and so that ideas, which have no impact, became an ever more valuable product. And what we're seeing is that the if you actually take the physical tonnage of the GDP, it hasn't changed since 1970. All of the growth in so-called real GDP is conceptual, not physical. And that means that very much fewer jobs are producing goods, physical things. And I think that that's probably not an accident. I mean, for example, unquestionably, the invention of the integrated circuit and the notion that silicon, a very easily available commodity, constructed this remarkable structure of electronics including the internet and all of the things we take for granted. I mean, I think I don't have my cell phone with me, which is a good thing because it makes noise. But that is an extraordinarily complex mechanism. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my early years, I used to have an IBM big computer, which was from here to over there. My iPhone right now has got far more capacity than that computer did.
Right.
The changes are all downsizing everything, and because you look at the value added of the country, is all conceptual, mm-hmm. and that means that manufacturing is going down, manufacturing jobs are going down. I'm not sure it turns around, because I think it's an irreversible trend, and one of the reasons why our educational system is such a concern, mm-hmm. because what we need are conceptual skills.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the other side of the room. What, right here in the front row? Yeah, right here.
To go back to bubbles, you were quoted in the newspaper in the last day or so as suggesting that virtual currencies such as bitcoins were a bubble. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, not virtual currencies as such. It's a question, really, of what is a currency and why do we care? Currency is the vehicle which, extraordinary human invention, which enables people, instead of bartering, which is what they did in early centuries, to actually take claims against potential future goods. And that's what a currency is. But in order for those claims to have value which is stored, so to speak, it's got to either have an intrinsic value, such as gold and silver, which, for whatever reasons, and it can't be inbred, human beings accept gold and silver in payment for other goods without asking from whom they're getting the monies. The second way of doing that is to have a currency which is essentially as good as gold. And what history has always taught us is that people will accept paper money if it has ultimate value. Paper money in itself isn't that. But all paper money comes out of an issue of trust. Anyone in this audience can create a currency of their own if people are willing to take their checks and circulate it as money because they trust the person who is issuing it. So I ask myself, what is the backing of Bitcoin? There is none that I can find. I mean, there's no ultimate means of payment, which is the case in an issue of so-called virtual currencies. And all of the currencies that we have in the world now are fiat money, but they're backed by pledges of the government who have resources which essentially make the currencies mm-hmm. worthwhile. Bitcoin does not, in my judgment, fall in that category, and if somebody can explain to me why I'm wrong, I'll change, but I don't get it.
I think it fell 16% in value today.
You did?
Yeah.
You're kidding me.
No. The rumor was that Baidu, the Chinese internet company, won't take Bitcoin now. Because the Chinese don't. Were you talking to the Chinese?
I was talking Chinese.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Great. Yeah, we have a very enthusiastic questioner here on the... right there. Yep.
You kind of touched on it, but there's been a lot of talk about how over the last 70, 80 years, the income distribution in the United States has really widened to a point now today where it's like it was in the 1920s. The wealthy are super wealthy. And I'm just wondering, I'm not an economist, what are the economic consequences of that? Is it something we should be worried about as an economist? And if so, what remedies are there, sort of, quote, socialism?
Yeah, I think the first thing you have to do is ask yourself, why? And why do we get that sort of phenomenon? And in the current context, it's caused by the fact that there are basically two different forms of sources of income in this type of society. One is the issue of production workers who get paid salaries or wages, and the other are those who are involved in the value of the capital assets of the society, which are instrumental in bringing standards of living up. It turns out that as the capital gets an ever larger proportion, because increasing productivity also implies the capital stock is rising per hour, and it means that the market value of that capital stock is rising and that it is only productivity which brings up the production level, production worker wages. When we're in a situation such as we are today, where stock prices are rising, capital asset prices are rising, but wages are very stagnant, this is engendering a major increase in income inequality, which is not resolvable because it's fundamental to the way our system is functioning. It's more a political problem than it is an economic problem. I mean, I do not see how you can maintain a democratic society when there are extreme differences. There are things we can do about it which we're not doing. I mean, for example, we have extraordinarily restrained the ability of people who, foreigners who come to the United States, earn degrees, and then are not given a green card. They go home. The reason this is important is that most of us here are probably being subsidized by the fact that competitors of ours are not being allowed into the country. And that means that our incomes are higher than they should be relative to everybody else. And if we were to allow a significant increase in people who would, I mean, my view is anyone who gets a PhD in physics, I don't care how potentially what kind of person he is or whether he's going to be destructive to the society or a spy or something like that. Those are the people you want in the economy, in the society. And if we can do that, it will create a clear case where income inequality will actually decrease, not because many of the areas where we usually think of the way we do it by raising the lower incomes. You get the same political effect if you lower upper incomes. People are interested not in their absolute levels of income, but in that relative to others. It's regrettable, the factor of how human beings are inbred and how they behave, how we behave. We all do it. And the result is that if you can basically bring down the upper level incomes by taking away our subsidies, that will have a significant that will cause a significant improvement in the political stability. But the way we're going now, I think, is essentially disruptive and potentially dangerous.
Let's see. Yes, ma'am, right here.
Hello, Mr. Greenspan. I've always found you fascinating and only thought of you in the business sense of the economics. My question is more of a personal nature. Being that you studied the clarinet at Juilliard early on, when you're away from all of this, and perhaps you're home and you're on your time, do you ever pick it up and just for your own enjoyment play the clarinet anymore, or did you leave it behind?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Let me say the answer is actually no. and for an important reason. A wind instrument player is builds up the muscles around your mouth, and when you're playing with something like the clarinet, who, you know, for years and years and years, you're used to hearing a sound which has got beautiful overtones and it really fills the room. You don't play for a month because, in my case, I retired from the music business. I played it, you know, I'd wait for a month and play it, and it sounded awful. So I don't play again for 6 months. And then I play, and it is unbelievable. And I give it up and take up the piano.
Yeah, any early tapes of your clarinet playing out there?
Yeah, there might be. Probably, yeah? It's part of a dance band.
Is that right? Yeah. I think the Free Library would like to put that in their rare books collection.
Yeah, well, that is very rare. Yeah. Well, do you remember Leonard Garment by chance?
No.
Leonard Garment was a very prominent figure in the Nixon administration who was sort of liberal.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, right.
He and I played side by side in a dance band.
Oh, we're going to have to go find this. Yeah.
And it's sort of a very interesting experience.
I bet it was. Well, I'm sorry. That concludes the event. I want to thank you. It was very illuminating and very interesting, and we here in Philadelphia appreciate the fact that you came here and visited us.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.